Hello everyone, and welcome to this one to last session of the second day of Tech Days. I hope you all had a great time today. Well, I see there's quite a lot of people here. I'm honored. I just hope it's not just because there's only two sessions in this time slot. I hope not to disappoint you. So this is actually a session on Silverlight, ModelView, ViewModel, and WCF RIA services. But I'd like to start with a little disclaimer. This is not a session about how to code this stuff. I'm actually not going to go too much into the specifics of getting your data to your client with Silverlight and WCF RIA services or something. This is a session that's actually aimed at the architecture of these types of solutions. So to say that if you don't like that, you can still leave, but please don't. So let's start by introducing myself. My name is Kevin. I'm a technical consultant and a solution manager rich applications at Real Dolmen, which is one of the bigger ICT companies in Belgium. I actually come from a web background, so I've been programming and doing stuff with .NET since about 8 years. And I gradually moved into the new stuff, Silverlight, XAML, even HTML these days. And you can find my coordinates on the slide. If after the session you still got questions or you want to drop me a mail, just let me know. And I'll try to answer. I've also authored the book, the Silverlight 5 Data and Services Cookbook, together with Gilles Clairen, who I also saw entering this room. Is over there. This is our second book. It's the follow-up to Silverlight 4 Data and Services Cookbook, and it's due in March this year. And I promise that's everything as far as commercial stuff is concerned. So what are we going to talk about today? Who's worked with WCF RIA services already, or who knows what it is? Okay, quite a few people. That's nice. For those who don't know it, I am going to start with a quick 101 on WCF RIA services. Again, not going too much into the details, I'm mainly going to focus on why you'd want to use it. Because actually this session is about getting something we get out of the box framework, WCF RIA services, and making it enterprise ready. So first of all, we will need to know why we want to insist on using that framework. And to do that, we need to know what it's all about. Now, we'll immediately go into one of the problems with WCF RIA services. Because, frankly, what you get out of the box, it's good for rapid application development, it's good for small consumer apps, but it's not too good for enterprise-grade applications. But the good thing is, it's very extensible, it's very powerful, so we can make it better, we can make it good. And that's what we'll do in the rest of the session. So, we've got our ModelView, ViewModel, WCF RIA services enabled solution. And we're going to ask ourselves a few questions. And then we're going to see how we can answer these questions by re-architecting and refactoring what we've got. First of all, we're going to get our solution to work with better project structure, more separation of concerns. And we're going to take that one step beyond and try to separate out the DAL. And, of course, we'll have to ask ourselves a few questions. Is it a good idea to do that, for example? What are the advantages and disadvantages? Because really there's no... I cannot end this session with a conclusion that says, this is how you should do it, this is how you should do it, and this is how you should do it then. Because all depends on your application requirements. So these are a combination of techniques which you can use in your projects depending on the requirements. Then we've got our solution set up and running, let's say. We're going to roll it out. And then you'll have to roll it out on the internet, for example, and you expose your application to a lot of intruders. And we're going to look at how we can limit these points of exposure to make your application as safe as possible. And again, these techniques have advantages and disadvantages. And then we're going to go back to our solution. We've got it rolled out, but maybe we want to do some more and look into some more techniques with WCF RIA services. We're going to use the domain service factory to insert an authenticated user, so we have an available client and server side. And of course, there's a lot more, and I'm quickly going to touch on those, and I'm going to provide you all with the codes on my blog. Okay, first rule, when you get your requirements from a customer and you're thinking about your architecture, you're not the first one who has to think about these problems. Probably most of the problems you're facing and we're facing every day have already been thought about by someone else. So one of the first things I want to advise you is look around, look at the internet, look at open source projects, because there's a lot of good stuff in there. For example, MVVM is more or less a given if you're working with XAML applications. I cannot imagine building one without. And the MVVM Lite Toolkit by Laurent is actually a very, very good one. And I use it in all my projects. So check that out if you want to use it. Another interesting one, WCF RIA Services Contrib. That's a collection of extension methods, APIs, etc., for use with WCF RIA services. It's open source. Everyone can contribute to it. I've actually contributed a few methods to that. So if you're working with WCF RIA services, it's very good to check out. And last shout out goes to Sandrino Di Mattia. It's actually a colleague of mine, very intelligent guy. And a few of the techniques I'm going to explain in this session were actually thought of by him. So check out his blog. WCF RIA Services 101. If you look up WCF RIA Services on the net, you will find the tagline, "It simplifies development of N-tier solutions for RIA." Okay, so it simplifies development. Then we have to ask ourselves the question, well, what's so hard about developing a rich internet application? And I'm going to take Silverlight as an example. As most of you probably know, when you're working with Silverlight, you're working async and service-oriented. So we're essentially always building a service-oriented architecture, and a service-oriented architecture brings with itself a few problems, or rather challenges. It's a nicer way of putting it. One of the typical ones, where are you going to write your validation? Where are you going to write your validation rules, your business rules, etc.? If you have a WinForms application, let's go back 5 years in time. You have a WinForms application working with a service layer, and you want to have validation on your entities. Okay, you should at least write it on the server, of course, that's for sure. But a lot of validation, well, it would be a shame to have to communicate with your server each time. For example, a required field validator, or is the value of this integer between 1 and 200, the typical simple validators. If you would only write your validation logic on the server, and you're working service-oriented, that would mean that for the simple required field validator, your application would have to communicate with the service layer and get back a bunch of validation errors, for example. That's not very effective. It's slow, it consumes bandwidth, etc., etc. This is often solved in a WinForms application by separating out your validation rules in a separate class library, and you simply reference it on both sides. That's a technique I see used often. Well, that's possible. That actually works for a bunch of validators. It gets a little bit harder when a validator has to communicate with your database again, for example, to check if a field is unique or something like that. But it's a technique that's used often. Same goes for your domain layer, your entities or your DTOs you want to send over the wire. Where do you put those? You need some at the client, you need some at the server, you can use proxy generation, you can use shared domain layer. All those are techniques that are time-tested and work with a WinForms app. But with a Silverlight app, it gets a bit more difficult, because while your service layer will be built against the full .NET CLR, your Silverlight application is built against, well, Silverlight CLR. And you can't just reference a full.NET assembly in Silverlight app. So that becomes a bit more difficult. Of course, there are also ways of working around that. You've got portable class libraries. In some projects, you see people linking their validators in two different projects, compiling them, one against full.NET, one against the Silverlight CLR, and then you can reference them on both sides. But it gets cumbersome. It requires quite a lot of plumbing. Same goes for your domain model, your entities. You could say, I only need some DTOs. So those are very simple classes. I can reference them on both sides. But then again, you need to raise property change notifications. You would probably like to validate the values you're setting your properties to in the property setter. So it becomes very difficult. It requires a lot of work to get that up and running. And that's one of the reasons I really like WCF RIA services. It's because it solved those problems for us. It actually ensures you only have to write your business logic, your validation, your business rules in one place, on the server. You write it on the server, you build your application, it gets generated on the client, and, well, it works. It's a lot. That's actually why it's aimed at rapid application development and marketed as such, because it, well, it enables rapid application development. It solves a lot of common problems. That's the first reason I like this framework. Second reason would be, well, the way of programming, the way of working. When you're working with RIA services, it almost feels as though you're not working service-oriented anymore. If some of you have worked with the entity framework before, you know you've got a context. You use it to load your entities in entity containers. You create a change set, and you submit it to your underlying data store, typically SQL Server database. Well, if you use WCF RIA service, it feels a lot like that. On the client, you get a domain context in which you load your entities. You can create a change set. You can submit it. And on the server side, your change set will be recreated and submitted to the database. That's the second reason, the way of programming. And the third reason, more and more important these days, you can expose the services you write for all kinds of technologies. A domain service, which is what you use in RIA services, can be exposed through a SOAP endpoint, through JSON endpoint for REST, through an OData endpoint. So you can access that from almost any technology, mobile or not. And there's actually a RIA/JS implementation, JavaScript implementation available, which enables you to create change sets client-side in JavaScript for use in your HTML5 applications. So it's one service layer accessible by a multitude of clients. That's the third reason. On the server, you will write domain services. That's the start, your services. Not regular WCF services, but domain services. It's actually WCF service that encapsulates some business logic. Second point of this slide is actually the most important one. It exposes a set of related operations. And now we're nearing the architecture point. You're going to architect your services. And the first advice I'd like to give is when you do that, logically divide them. So imagine you have an application which has a part of employee management, an accounting part, a reporting part. Well, if you hear me say it like this, you can already imagine. You should also create your domain services so they correspond to a logical piece of your application, to a logical module of your application. So don't just write one big domain service and put everything in there. No, just write small domain services that only expose what's needed for a certain module of your application. That immediately allows you to reuse a lot of those. And what you get on the client, once you build, is what I just said, actually. And I'm going to keep on using that database metaphor here, because it's a really nice way of explaining this. On the client, for each domain service, you will get a domain context. And you can look at that as your client-side database server. Mind the quotes. Because it's actually used to move entities between the client and the server. Behind screens, it's just a WCF channel factory, by the way. And you've also got your entity container. Look at it as the database, again, mind the quotes, which stores entity sets, which in turn can be looked at as tables, collections of entities of a specific type. That's actually a pretty nice metaphor to look at the client side of WCF RIA services. And then I'm going to go into some code now. So say hello to Nico. Nico is, of course, singer of the Velvet Underground, but also an acronym for Nice and Interesting Company, which is a fictive company we are now going to build an application for. Very simple application, Silverlight app. It loads some data. It allows me to add, update, and delete entities and submit them to the server. I'm just going to use this to show you how RIA services works and what you get out of the box. This is what we've got. Two projects, a Silverlight client and a hosting web application. In your hosting web application, you've got your data model, in our case, a bunch of books, to put it simple. You've got a domain service. This domain service consists, let's make this a bit bigger. I don't know, can you guys read that? I think you can. You've got a query method, getBooks. What's this for? This is used to load data to the client. And for each entity that needs to be editable, you've got insert, update, and delete methods on the server. And these are actually used to recreate the change set server side. So this is a very simple service. It only exposes one operation, one entity. Once you build this, you will get a generated code folder in your Silverlight app, which will contain, let's see, where is it? Your entities. These are client-side versions of the server-side entities. You might want to look at it as the domain. And it also contains the context, which is used to transfer your entities back and forth. And normally we should see a query method as well, and here we go. Also generated method for the getBooks method on the server. That's actually, very simply put, what it does on build. How are you going to work with this? Well, of course, we're using MVVM. I have a books view model. I have an instance of my context to transfer back and forth. A simple property, a list of books, which I can bind to my UI. I've created a few commands, but this is what's important. I'm going to load my data. Once this is loaded, the entity set of books is filled, so I can bind it to my UI. And I've added a very simple method to remove a book, update a book, and add a book to my context. So what I'm actually doing here is I'm simply creating a change set, to put it very simple. And then I have one more thing, a submit command, which submits the changes to my domain service, actually. So if you look at this way of programming, there's not a lot of, well, service-oriented programming going on. It feels a lot like just regular non-async programming, which can happen thanks to the fact that the observable pattern is heavily used in Silverlight. Now, what happens when I submit these changes? I'm going to add, update, delete a few things, and submit. All of a sudden, I'm at my server. And you will see that the insert method gets executed. So on my server side, object context, it's actually the entity framework at work here. I insert the book, I update the book, a book gets deleted. And then we get into the persist change set method, which will actually just make sure our entity framework can persist the changes to my underlying data store. I'm not going to do that because that will screw up my database, of course. But that's, in essence, what happens. And I hope you can see this is pretty, pretty nice to be able to work like this. But immediately, you will probably see a few problems with this. So, this is marketed for rapid application development, and the templates are aimed at rapid application development. So, as a general rule, you might want to say it's not good enough for enterprise-grade applications. If you look at the solution I just showed you, it only has two projects, Silverlight client and a host. And that host contained my DAL, my EDMX, let's say. It contains my services, so the service host is the web host. The service names aren't too friendly. And, well, there's not a lot of separation going on here. There's not a lot of possibility for reuse of my code here. Everything is in the same place. If that web application fails, everything will fail. Very typical problem when you are building an application which has different types of clients, so a service layer and a mobile app on top of that, a web app, a Silverlight app on top of that. Well, if you're hosting your Silverlight app in the same place as your services, and that application pool fails, all the other clients will also fail because they can't access their service layer anymore. So this is actually pretty bad. It's good for, well, marketing purposes, but so let's see how we can make that better. This is the default we had. This is what you get when you create a WCF RIA services application from Visual Studio. Everything in the same place, easy, fast, but not suited for enterprise-grade apps. Luckily, it gets better. There's also something in Visual Studio called a RIA services class library template. It's already a bit better. I'm immediately going to show you. That's this one, I think. Yep. That's TFS. This is the same solution as I've just shown you, the same project. But this time, I've used RIA services class library instead of regular WCF RIA services. You see, we get two extra projects here. Nico.services.web, which contains my domain services and my model. And Nico.services, which actually, if I show you all the files, contains the generated code. Now, I reference the Nico.services.web in my web host, and I reference the file with the generated code in my client. And what have we done now? We can actually reuse a bit of this. You can just take your nico.services.web, which contains your services, and reference it in another host. And you can take your nico.services assembly and reference it in the Silverlight applications that need to communicate with that host. It works, but it's still not perfect, because what do we see? The services are still, by default, hosted in the same host as the Silverlight app. So again, your web host fails, your service layer fails, every client connecting to it fails. Your data access layer is in the same place as your services. And the project names are actually quite unfriendly and confusing. So you've got, by default, it's called RIA Services Library, but in this example, Nico.services.web sounds a bit weird to me. It shouldn't be .web. It contains services, not necessarily that they have to be hosted in a web app. And Nico.services That contains my generated code. What's in the generated code? It's actually, if you look at it the MVVM way, for a lot of applications, that's my model. It contains my client-side entities. It contains the way I'm going to talk to my services. That's actually what we would call the model in a lot of applications. So the naming should be better. Luckily, we can do that. So this is where we're coming from. And this is what we want to end up with. We're going to refactor what we have now to make it more suited for an enterprise-grade architecture. And I've already taken a head start. Let's close this down. So, this is what we got now. I haven't used any templating here. Because if you look at it, what are these templates? These templates are, well, easy ways to get started with development. It's actually just a combination of rules that say this project will have that name and will contain these references by default. The web.config will contain that code. But there's nothing stopping us from doing this ourselves. And it's actually very easy. I've created nico.services, a simple .NET class library. And I've created nico.silverlight.client.model. This is where I want my generated code from my domain service to end up in. Because in essence, it's the model. Then I've created a web app, a service host. That one's going to host my services. And I'm going to try to give it some friendly names. What I need to start with, my nico.services project will need a domain service. So I'm going to add that. Domain. Well, let's name that book domain service. And now you'll see the wizard coming up. If you work with WCF RIA services, you know this one. What is this? Well, this is actually something that generates a lot of code for us. If you have a data model, book club entities in my case only exposes one item, a book. But if you have an existing EDMX file for most applications, it can contain quite a lot of entities with relationships, etc., etc. This wizard generates the necessary query methods to load them to your client, and if you wish, insert, update, delete methods for you. I don't actually like to use them, and I'll tell you why. If you do it like this at the start of a project, what will typically happen? In a typical project, well, I don't really know what I will have to insert, update, delete at the moment I'm starting. Maybe the project deadline is 6 months away, or you're not completely ready figuring out what the client wants yet. So what happens is, we just click everything. That happens a lot. We click every entity because we assume, well, maybe we'll need it in our application once. And we click enable editing on every entity as well. Because, well, maybe I'll need to edit it once. Problem is, in your head you might say, oh, well, I'll clean this up at the end of the project. But that never happens. At the end of the project, the deadline approaches and you say, well, it works, I'm not going to take the risk of cleaning this up. Well, instead of cleaning it up, a good thing is make sure it's never there. So I tend not to use this. Why did I want to show it to you then? Because it contains a nice checkbox, expose O data endpoint. That's one of the things I said earlier. Out of the box with RIA services, you get the ability to expose your domain service as an OData, read-only, endpoint, so it can be consumed by other apps. If you want to expose it as a SOAP endpoint, or JSON-based, you can get that as well. It's in the RIA services toolkit, and it's actually the easiest way to get it is from NuGet. Just get it, it will install the package and create two extra lines of code in your webconfig, and you've got your endpoints to use in other apps. For now, I'm just going to generate an empty book domain service. So how do I get around all that repetitive code? Because insert update leads for every entity. Well, it's a lot of repetitive code. Well, I kind of like working with let's see, where are they? Here you go. It's very easy to create this. And it makes sure we think more about what we expose. Because, well, your domain service will be exposed to the internet, typically, or to the intranet in some cases. Say you're building an internet app. You do not want to expose more than what's needed. Not just keeping your code clean, just for people with bad intentions who might want to hack into your application. If your service layer exposes more than what's needed, you give them more points of access to your app. So we should really avoid that. Okay. In this case, I am actually going to need all of them. And insert updates and a delete method. So just with a few code snippets, you're going to be running quite fast as well. Okay, that's part one. My domain service is ready. Now I need a way to make sure my generated code ends up in my other project, nico.silverlight.client.model. And how do you do that? Well, that's also pretty simple, actually. Just go to the project properties, and you'll see the WCF RIA services link. It's this that ensures, well, that tells the compiler on build where it should put the generated code. So if you're creating your projects by yourself and you want your generated code from the domain service to end up somewhere, just make sure you set the WCF RIA services link to the project which contains your domain services. And you're set. Let's see if I can prove that. There we go. Generated code is showing up. Let's look into that. And as we can see, we've got the book entity exposed by our domain service. And we also have the context. So there we go. Generated code and better naming. That's what we have. But still, it's not really very good, because I would kind of like to make sure my services are hosted somewhere else than my Silverlight app, to enable the Silverlight app to break without imposing the good up and running, good working of the other applications. So I'm going to try and host my domain services in another service host. So what do I need? Of course, I will need to add a reference to nico.services, as that one contains my domain services. It's here already. That's good. And now I'm simply going to add an SVC file, an empty SVC file. Just going to include it in my project. I'm going to name it bookservice.svc. And I'm going to change what's in the markup. And what am I going to put here? I'm going to say, well, this SVC, well, that's actually the nico.services.bookdomain service. That's my service I want to expose to the outside world. And the tricky part is, well, the nice part is, we're going to tell WCF, in this case, how it should instantiate this SVC file. I'm going to say, well, this is the service, and you need to instantiate it using the domainservices.hosting.domainservicehostfactory. And that's actually all there is to it. This is what instantiates all domain services out of the box. So if you want some friendly naming for your services, and you want them in some other place than in your web host, you can simply add this service, bookservice.svc, to another web host, tell it where it can find the implementation of the service, and tell it how it should create them through the service and factory attributes. Okay. I'm probably going to have to prove that as well. So let's browse to it. And there we go. Bookservice.svc gets instantiated as it should. Okay, so we've got good project naming. We've got separation of our service host and our web host. Now there's one thing more we need to do. We need to make sure our domain context client side knows where it should find its domain service. Because the reason why in both the regular WCF RIA services template and the class library template, the reason why your domain service ends up in the same place as your Silverlight app, was where your Silverlight app is hosted, is because by default, the domain context goes, when it's instantiated, looks for the domain service in the same place as where it's hosted, the Silverlight app is hosted. Luckily, you can easily change that just by passing where it should find the domain service in the constructor. So let's have a look at that. There we go. Let's uncomment that. This is actually the instantiation of my domain context. And the thing I pass in here is the URI of my domain service, which is now friendly named bookservice.svc. Now let's quickly uncomment some more code so I can prove this works. My view model contains the context. Well, it's the same context as for my complete application in this case. Again, a books property, which can easily be bound to my UI. And a simple load operation to load a bunch of books through the context. Okay. Probably going to have to kill this. There we go. Let's rebuild this and quickly run it. Should be almost ready. It's not that big of a project. And there we go. And now we can start. And there we go. It's exactly the same as application as we had before. But it's more separated out, refactored better, and lots of its components can be reused across projects. Okay. Now, that's actually normal. Each time I close Visual Studio, it happens. So this is what we've got until now. And this offers us a few advantages, as I've already told you about. But we can go even one step beyond this. We can separate out the DAL with a few tricks, actually. But it can be done. So what we want to end up with now is a project structure or the solution structure with a data access layer in a separate project. Because it's, again, a little higher degree of separation, and it allows the reuse of my data access layer in other projects. So let's see how that can be done. That should be this one. There we go. Yep, here we are. So how could this be done? Because it's actually, there are quite a bit of dependencies on how WCF RIA services works. The metadata should still be in the same place as your EDMX file. And typically the domain service expects the same namespace to find the entities it works on. So it's not that simple to do it, but it can be done. So this is a solution we previously had, actually. And as you can see, domain service and model in the same place. So now I'm going to add a project. Well, I'm just going to include it because I already have it. Again, a simple class library. That should be right about here. There we go. And I would like to put the metadata and the model in the other assembly. How can you do that? Well, as odd as it may sound, I'm going to copy-paste it. There we go. I'm going to do one thing. That is, I'm going to have to change the default namespace so it matches the namespace of my domain service. And I will, of course, have to reference it. And there we go. Okay, the build has succeeded. So let's run this. And there we go. Same project, same results, but my data access layer is separated out. Okay, does anybody see any problems with that? Because actually, I've separated out the DALL into a different assembly. But it's more or less a trick. This is as far as you can go with WCF RIA services at the moment. But the metadata is still in the same place as my entity model. And in fact, I haven't really decoupled it. I've just, well, divided the implementation of a namespace across different assemblies. So why would you use this? Why would you use this? Is it a good idea to do it? Should you? Shouldn't you? Well, I think you often end up working for projects where there already are big existing data access layers in place, big existing entity models, for example. If that's the case, this might make sense, in my head at least. It might make sense to do it like this. But for most projects, I actually wouldn't do this. Because if you remember what I said in the beginning, make sure your domain services are small. Your domain services only expose a set of related operations, a set of related entities. That's typically not a very big amount of entities. So if that's the case, I think your entity model should also only expose those entities. It's not because there's a huge database lying around somewhere that your entity model should include all the entities from the database. Just keep that small as well, and keep those in separate assemblies, by which I mean one assembly for each domain service. That way you have nice separation, nice reuse of code, and you don't have to start using tricks like this. But if you have an existing EDMX that's huge, and it's not possible to change it, this might be a way of getting it up and running. So we've got our application. It's up and running. There's nice separation of concerns. It's reusable, all you want, and you roll it out. And then someone breaks in. What have we done wrong? This is what happens with a regular Silverlight application. The one we had in the beginning, the one you get when you don't do anything about it. You've got your Silverlight app, you've got a web host which contains your services, and it goes completely back to your database in the end. This means that once someone breaks into your web host, they've immediately got access to your database. Well, depending on how it looks internally, but typically it's quite easy to get the database from there. So this is quite a bad thing. You don't want someone who has access to your web server immediately get access to your database, which is only used by the services. So this is what our current application does. It's already a bit better. You've got separate tiers on separate physical, well, on separate web servers, let's say. We're living in a world where everything gets virtualized, so I shouldn't say physical machines, but on separate web servers. So it's already a bit better. Our Silverlight app talks to, well, it's hosted on a web host, but the web host isn't connected to the database anymore. So if someone breaks into the web host, not a problem for our database. Then again, we're using WCF RIA services, or, well, a service-oriented approach, and our app is hosted somewhere on the net. So those services should be exposed to the internet as well. Which means once someone breaks into the service host, which is also actually just a web application in this case, they still have access to our database. So it's better than what you get out of the box, but if you roll out what I've just shown you, well, people can still break in quite easily. So what do we want to end up with? We want to limit the points of exposure to one point of exposure. We want to try to not expose our service host to the net anymore, even though typically WCF RIA services requires your service host to be exposed. So what would this mean? We only have a web host exposed to the net. So someone breaks into the web host. The web host isn't connected to the database anymore. The web host needs to go to the service host to go to the database. So there's another wall between your database and the outside world. So let's see how we can do this. We've actually only got a single point of exposure like this. The solution lies in IIS, actually. Application request routing and URL rewrites. Those are the two things we're going to use to get this done. The application request routing, that's something you can download and install. It's just a module for IIS. It's not in there by default, but you can download it just from Microsoft.com. And through our ARR, we're going to use that to make IIS act as a reverse proxy. What does that mean? What does a reverse proxy do, actually? It's going to retrieve resources from one or more servers, but it's going to make it look as though it came from that proxy. So the only thing that's exposed to the outside world is that address of that proxy, not servers behind it. So in our case, what are we going to do? We're going to retrieve data from the service hosts, but we're going to make it look as though it originated from the web host. So the app connects to the web host, which is actually the reverse proxy, and never to the service host. So let's see. The first thing I need to do, I need to fake a few things on my PC. I've edited the host file so I can have two web servers on my machine. So that's the first thing I did. And then I've installed, let's see, where have we got it? The application request routing module. The only thing you need to change here to get this up and running is to enable it as a proxy. That's it. So nothing more there. And then I've created two sites, Nico Service Host and Nico Web Host. That's it, actually. If you look at the bindings, Nico Service Host binds to host name Nico Web Host. Nico Web Host binds to Nico Web Host, Nico Service Host to host name Nico Service Host. So they're both accessible from my machine, from fake web server, actually. That's all we need to do as far as IIS is concerned and as far as setting that up is concerned. So now let's open my app. That's the next one. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to publish my two sites, my service host and my web host, and I'm going to publish them to my IIS. Up until now, we've always used a development server. So, let's see. This is what we need to do. Our service host, let's publish that one. To Nico Service Host, of course. Publish.
And it's done. To web hosts. I'm going to publish that one to Nico web host. Publish. So normally, I should be able to access Nico service host / book service, I think it was called. There we go. That's my service on this address. And on my Nico web host, should be my Silverlight app. There we go. Nothing special happened here. I just published both my applications on my local IIS. Now, I want to make sure my service is actually accessible through not Nico service host, but Nico web host. And once that's done, I can actually just throw away the Nico service host. Well, I can block that from the outside access. And how do you do that? Well, you just create a rewrite rule. Just take the nico.silverlight.webhost app, go in the webconfig file. Here we go. I add one rewrite rule, reverse proxy to the service host. And I'm going to say that everything that comes in that matches RIA services in this case will be rewritten to Nico service host / and the actual domain, the actual service name. So that means that every request can now go to my web host instead of to my service host. Okay, let's see if I can publish that. I really have to watch out here because typically you run into a few not found or invalid errors because a typical browser caches a lot. So let's see. Normally, Nico web hosts, and if I now go to RIA services / book service, I have access to Nico service host behind screens. So with this in place, I could say, well, I'm now going to block Nico service host from internet access. Simple as that. Because even though I'm surfing to Nico web host / RIA services, that's what it looks like to the outside world and to my Silverlight application. But in fact, it's going through to Nico service host / book service. Now, of course, I need to change one more thing. My Silverlight application itself. It shouldn't instantiate its domain context through Nico service host anymore, but it should use Nico web host / RIA services / book service. Now let's rebuild again. And if I now publish this one, there we go. If I now publish my web host again, now let's see. I'm probably going to run against an error here, but we'll see. Nico web host. No, there we go. My Silverlight application using the new Nico web host / RIA services URI is still up and running and working. And we've only got one point of exposure now instead of the two. Now, that's another technique you can use. But is there any problem with this? Because what have we done now? I was saying a few slides before this one, I was talking about separating out your services to the service host and the Silverlight app or any client to another web host. But what have we done in this case? Well, we've only got one point of exposure. So again, once that website fails, all your services fail. So that's really a trade-off you have to make. Do you want one point of exposure and risk the fact that once that one's application pool fails, your services won't be accessible, not for other applications either, not for other clients either? Or do you want to keep multiple points of exposure, ensuring your services are still accessible by other clients? That's one of the choices you have to make when rolling this out. Okay, another typical problem, authentication. In WCF RIA services, you've got authentication services, which work behind screens with simple ASP.NET. But often the authenticated user is required from both client and server. You have that, of course, through the identity and system security principle. But what you have there are only two things. You've got a name, which is its unique identifier, let's say, a unique key of the user, and the fact that he's authenticated or not. That's what you typically get. But often, in a lot of applications, you need more than that. It's not that difficult to imagine an application where you have a user who logs in, and that user has rights to a number of orders, for example. Each user has rights to a number of orders. And the data he gets from the server depends on those orders. What do you do to make sure that user only gets those orders from the service call? Lots of things can be done. What's seen often is inputting the orders as parameters to your service methods. That's one way of doing it. Another way of doing it is your server side, get your authenticated user, write a query to get it from the database, get its orders, and limit the final query like that. That's also possible. That means every service method requires an extra query or a more difficult one. What we're going to try here is getting a typed, so not just an I principle, but a typed user, both on client and server, including a bunch of properties, for example, orders, which you can then use to limit your queries and stuff like that. And we're going to try to get that automatically, so you don't have to write any more code in each method or input a bunch of parameters. So how can we do that? I'm just going to take the completed one. The way you do this is you've already seen the domain service factory, which was used to make sure we could get friendly service naming. The domain service factory creates and instantiates my domain services. We can use that in another way as well. You could say, well, we're going to take that domain service factory and extend it a bit. And we're going to make sure that each time the domain service factory instantiates a domain service, which is actually on each call, we're going to input that typed user. So the typed user is available in our domain service and can be used throughout each method. Let's see how we can do that. So again, I'm starting out here. And I've had a simple project which contains my Nico user, simple user. It inherits from user base. User base contains is authenticated name and a bunch of roles. It's actually typical iPrinciple, iUser, iIdentity stuff. That's what you need. But nothing more than that. So I extend that one with two extra properties, a dummy property and a list of integers in this case. Now, as we're working with WCF RIA services, I only need to expose this user on the server side. I expose it on the server side, and WCF RIA services will generate that typed user on my client.
So as far as the getting your user on the client part is concerned, you get that out of the box. That's actually very easy. Just create an authentication service in my services. There we go. An authentication service which works on Nico user. I'm not going to go into the specifics of this implementation, but in essence, it uses, where do we go? Here you can see it. It's actually just simple ASP.NET forms authentication in this case, or Windows authentication, but in this case, forms authentication behind screens. So if you work with ASP.NET, this is actually not very different from that. So what do I do here? The get user method returns a new dummy user in case. With a dummy property with value, dummy value, and a list of a few integers, just to show you how I can get those client and server side. So that's all there is to it as far as the client is concerned. So let's see that. Normally I should break. And there we go. Just for demo purposes, I've logged in with my name. And I'm going to see if my user is typed. And as you can see, I hope you can see that here. But I'm at my client in my Silverlight app. I've logged in. And as you can see, we have a typed user, Nico user, which has my dummy value property and a collection of my three dummy order IDs. So that's as far as the client side is concerned. It's actually pretty easy. But what happens now? How do I get this on the server? So let's see if this works. I'm going to load my books, which will, of course, get me to my server side. Here we go, get books method. And I see that there's a bunch of code here, and apparently there's an authenticated user here. Let's see if I can get that one. I'm on the server side, and even there I have my valid order IDs and my typed user with dummy value. So we know it's possible. But how is this possible? And that's where the domain service factory comes into play. In the place where you are hosting your domain services, by default, there's a domain service factory that takes care of creating and instantiating them. That's just contained in the assemblies you use from WCF RIA services. But you can change that a bit. Just add a global.asax file. And in this, you create your own domain service factory. Domain service factory simply inherits from iDomain service factory. And in the create method, that's where we get our Nico user. This authentication part, it's to reuse of the domain service, the authentication domain service we're using from WCF RIA services. So I'm just fetching my user, and I am creating a new instance of my domain service, and I put in the user I've just fetched, ensuring that each time my domain service is accessed, it has access to a typed user. Now, okay, that makes it easy for developers. That makes it easy to develop. You don't have to add parameters to your methods anymore. You don't have to create extra queries to get to orders from a specific user. But this actually does mean that on each service call, you have a hit on your database to fetch the current logged in user. That's normally not the case. What could you do? You could cache this, of course. So what I've done here is I've just accessed it straight from the service, so it goes straight to the database. which you could cache this HTTP context can be cached. So that limits the hits to your database and still ensures you have a typed user on both sides of the app. So that's another something that can be done. Okay, is there more? Yes, of course there's more, but there's not a lot of time left. And I would like to leave a few minutes for questions. So all the code, which is about this, and all that I've shown is going to be on my blog in a few hours probably. But a few more pointers here for error handling. Each domain service has an onError method. In that onError method, you can plug in any logging exception handling component you wish. So use that to catch your errors on the server side already. If you want to use server-side paging together with MVVM, it's possible as well. That's actually something that's a requirement for most apps. But it's not that easy to get working out of the box. But for that, the RIA Services Toolkit contains a domain collection view. It's really a very powerful collection type. So if you're looking for server-side paging, ensure you do that. Server-side paging and store queries, like store procedures, for example, it's even a bit more difficult. But for that, you can also use the domain collection view, including an extra output parameter on your operation signature, which is in the code I will provide to you. So the session summary, and I hope I have convinced you of this a bit, is that WCF RIA services really is quite powerful and extensible. And if you look beyond the marketing talk, you can actually find an enterprise-grade framework. An enterprise-grade framework that still gives you all the stuff you get from the rapid application development framework, like the common concerns that are tackled, etc., etc. And what may be obvious after all the sessions you've followed in the last 2 days, that the future really is an API. We're living in a world where more and more different clients need to connect to your services. Your customers want a mobile client, an iPhone client, a tablet client, a web client, a desktop client. You need to make sure they can get that. And you need to make sure you can get that. They can get it in a way that's a bit cost effective for you as well. So if you develop your application by separating it out, separating it into different components, which are then exposed as an API, well, then I think you're doing it the right way. So, are there any questions left? Anyone?
Mm-hmm. Which was meant to standardize that kind of identification about you plug your client go to service, get the authorization and standardized way. Is it possible with the
So you're actually asking about identity foundation integration in Silverlight RIA services. That's actually possible, yes. You can find a few nice examples online, and there's actually one in the book that's coming out. It's not a plug, but it can be done. At a certain client I'm working for, we're having an active federation scenario, which uses Swift together with Silverlight and WCF RIA services. And passive federation is even a bit more easy to get up and running. So stuff like that is possible. You can find in the Windows Identity Foundation training kit, there's a bunch of classes you can use to get claims in your Silverlight app. So if that's what you're looking for, check that out. Any more questions? If someone more than five rows away has a question, shout, because I really can't see you. Okay. In that case, I thank you for coming, and I hope you liked the session.